Hello and welcome back to Millennial 2021. This is the second night, and there are going to be four streams tonight. Let me see. In two hours, it will be Survive the Jive, and then Mark Gullick, and then Charles Robertson. But first, it's UK Column. Now, I have three representatives from UK Column here. This is Brian Gerrish, David Scott, and Alex Thompson. Now, I last had UK Column on in 2017, which is, I don't know, there have been various reasons why they haven't been on since, but I wanted to have them on since then, but unfortunately it just wasn't possible for various reasons. But I'm a big fan of UK Column, and especially, and I'll introduce you this way. A lot of people might have once thought UK Column is a conspiracy-based thing. It goes into that sort of territory. And a lot of people have been skeptical of that whole area until the last maybe 5 years, and then especially the last 2 years. I think a lot of people are now much more amenable to the notion of things being orchestrated behind the scenes, and sometimes openly, shamelessly, than they once were. And we're going to talk about the last 2 years. So welcome, UK Column. Thank you for agreeing to appear.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's okay. Alex there. Yeah, it's Brian and David.
It's lovely to be here. It's been a while since 2017.
Yes,
I remember in 2017, we were sitting in, I think, Brian Gerrish's kitchen, the three of us.
Yes.
Squeezed in quite narrowly, and we were talking about how dire 2017 had been compared to 2016, which was an absolute hoot.
Yes. Yeah, it's strange because in different years have different pluses and minuses. And 2016 had been a hoot, but 2017 was a big year for dissidents. It was a very good year for that kind of thing. But the world was clearly getting darker. I mean, Trump had got elected and the Syria stuff had started, which had immediately ended the honeymoon period for Trump. But anyway, I would like to ask you, I mean, clearly the world has transformed since then. You know, it feels like a different age. When I think about, you know, in 2017, I was doing very well on YouTube. Since then, everything has darkened in terms of the online world. The online world, social media, has become a system for control rather than a system for freedom of speech. So would any of you like to talk about that?
Well, I, if I may, I'll respond to that straight away and say that if you're still on YouTube, you're doing well, because, of course, the UK Column was banned from YouTube a few months ago.
And oh, no, I was banned in February.
Okay, well, you beat us to it then. Well done. but perhaps I'm allowed to just add, and if your listeners, viewers and listeners would like to know why we were banned, it's because we put up a audio testimony of a lady whose husband had suffered from neurological damage after having the vaccine. Guillain-Barré syndrome, and he'd ultimately been paralyzed from the neck down. So we just simply broadcast her testimony, which was very quiet, very measured, but very emotional. And that produced us a ban on YouTube. And then I think it was
a little wrinkle to that story, actually, was we didn't get immediately banned. The video was up, the offending video was up for about 3 weeks. It was then picked up by a conservative woman who we suspect is read by Tory Central Office. They did a transcript of the piece and linked to our video. Then we got banned.
Then we got banned. And then a few weeks later, the Daily Mail ran exactly the same story. And the key part of the story was that when this unfortunate gentleman suffered the vaccine adverse reactions, he went on to a ward where the doctors diagnosed it as a adverse vaccine reaction. It was diagnosed as Guillain-Barré syndrome, and there were at least six other men on the ward, all with similar neurological damage. When the Daily Mail printed the story, it was acceptable, but the UK column, having broadcast that story weeks earlier, we were banned.
There was a time, Brian, when we were actually, I think, a year and a half ahead of the Daily Telegraph on one of the COVID stories. I forget which one.
Yes. Well, there's been a number. Well,
That was Sage and the Sage Minutes that described how they were going to increase people's sense of personal risk in order to control their behaviour. I think that was it.
Yeah.
And at that point, of course, the Daily Telegraph had to come out with it because Laura Dodsworth had written a whole book on this theme, State of Fear, in which she never gives attribution to UK column, but I think clearly she'd read us quite thoroughly because she was in every UK column talking point in that book.
This is quite remarkable that you could get punished. How many subscribers did the YouTube channel have?
We were just shy of 100 grand, so we didn't quite get our silver album. I think perhaps they were minded not to give us that.
Yeah, I think a lot of people get frozen at about 90, 95, 96, 98, yeah. and mysteriously never make it to 100,000. That's happened to a lot of people that I remember. That's a big loss, and I'm sorry for that. My own channel, I think, had 57,000, I think it was at the end. But I think it's what's incredible about all of this is that there is no way to put it to YouTube that what they banned you for is something that the Daily Mail?
Daily Mail, yeah.
Daily Mail reported a few weeks later. There's no way to reason with them and say, can't you see that you've done something irrational and unfair? This is something that, as a feature of this age, is these massive monolithic corporations that you cannot reason with. I think that's a big characteristic of this. I think,
like you, Colin, we've also had our run-ins with Twitter. I'm a Twitter refugee as well. I got banned from Twitter. And the first strike I got, I was actually doing it in real time because I was on the UK column news, and Mike had organised there's a database that the government put out called the Yellow Card System, which reports on vaccine adverse reactions. And it was basically, if it were a pencil written ledger faxed to somebody and then scanned and then put up, it wouldn't have been any more crude. It was basically an Excel spreadsheet, and it was almost impossible to find anything. So we got all the information out of this and put a front end on, so you could search for things that you could understand. You could say, okay, headaches or pains or leg pain or problems with eyes or whatever it was.
Or yeah, compare jab manufacturers.
Yeah.
Well, should we just focus a bit on this? One thing I'd like to say is the other member of the team is Mike Robinson, who's not here. And I'd like to give him a mention because it was Mike Robinson and his team that actually built the database, the searchable database for the yellow card data. Yeah. But I think your audience would want to know that the official figures from the MHRA, that's the UK's Medicines and Health Products Regulatory Agency, it collects data on vaccine adverse reactions. And the total to date is 1,314,639 recorded adverse reactions and total fatalities, 1,822. And those figures should be considered, bearing in mind that the MHRA was prepared to admit that probably less than 10% of adverse reactions got recorded, and probably down to about 2-4% of serious adverse effects. So that isn't the UK's columns data, that is the government, the UK government's official data, but the MHRA provided that data in a very clumsy system that was very difficult to search. And so Mike Robinson and the team built this amazing front end to allow people to search the government's own data. But this is where we are with vaccine adverse effects in UK.
And so my Twitter ban, my first Twitter strike suspension came. Mike had created this website. It took nothing but the government's own data and simply made it searchable. I thought, that's fantastic. And I tweeted it out whilst we were live on air. And whilst we were live on air, about 5 minutes later, I got a message to say my Twitter account had been closed down.
For medical misinformation, was it, David? I can't remember what they accused
me of. They came up with a few explanations as to why they cancelled me, but yeah, that was the main one.
Yeah. See, that it's just so incredible. You know, the medical misinformation from the UK government's own data.
Yeah. But it actually makes sense because I'm going to be very direct here and say if people want to know how the scam works, the scam is very simple. The MHRA collects data, which is recorded on vaccine adverse reactions. So it sucks all that data in. It does print it on sheets, which are very difficult to view and analyze, but it does produce that data. But there's then no risk assessment, no analysis done on the data which it has collected. So the MHRA, and June Rain is the chief executive, who's usually the spokesperson. She's the one who constantly says, well, the vaccines are working, they're safe, benefits outweigh the risks. But the scam is that they've never investigated their own data on the risks, even though we've got over 1,800 people dead and over a million adverse effects.
We better tell the audience that the buck doesn't stop there, because we like to use our research skills, in which Mike, who's not with us this evening, is supreme on the statistical side, but we all have our contributions to make. We have found that the MHRA only poses as the data owner. Actually, the decisions clinically have to be made, as far as we now understand, by a Dr. Pierre Mohammed. Perhaps you might want to add something about him, Brian.
Well, yes, this is the Commission on Human Medicines, which is another part of this soup of organisations which the UK government claims are looking after our health and well-being and safety as far as vaccinations are concerned. So that gentleman is the head of the Commission on Human Medicines, and that organisation holds ultimate responsibility for vaccine safety, but they never speak out. You never hear them say anything. It's always, I'll say, delegated back down the line to June Rain from MHRA. So there's a little system, and it works by the fact that there's lots of good words about who is working hard to protect us from any possible vaccine damage. But the reality is that they never act on any of the information that they've got. What they are doing on a hour-by-hour, day-by-day basis is working with the pharmaceutical companies. And this is to such an extent that if you look at the MHRA board meetings, which you can find on YouTube, listed as MHRA board meetings. I'm afraid I've forgotten her name, but one of the members of the board has allegiance to Bill and Melinda Gates and their organisation. So there is no independence in the MHRA whatsoever. And its primary function is to help develop the pharmaceutical industry worldwide and to increase their profits.
I think what we're getting at is there are some surprising, maybe not so surprising, similarities between how this scam is operated and how in previous events or reporting that we're known for, establishment complicity in child abuse is covered up. A lot of buck passing and a lot of leaving local or better known faces to face the music, to leaving councils in that case to sink or swim. And in this case, as Brian describes, there is a line right up to the Secretaries of State, who never seem to take responsibility for anything. I think one of the best quotable quotes from last year's millennial, Colin, was Godfrey Bloom, when he came on and he was speaking about Britain's then Secretary of State for Health before his fandango with his assistant, which, of course, may have been mise en scène in order to shuffle him off to his next technocratic post. But anyway, he was Health Secretary at that point, as you recall. And Godfrey Bloom memorably told you in Millennial 2020, at the investment bank I used to work for, Hancock wouldn't have even got in to clean the bloody cars. And it doesn't help that he looks like a child molester. So, again, people are noticing comparisons between different establishment scandals.
Yeah, indeed. I think that... when I first discovered UK Column, it was, if I recall correctly, it was to do with... this is an interesting historical comparison. I think I'd like to bring Brian in here on this. There was the world of the 2000s and the late 2000s. I think that was when the smoking ban came in, and there was the climate change thing was going on. They were trying to sell it then, and then I became aware of UK Column through or Brian Gerrish as an individual at that time because of the Common Purpose phenomenon. Brian, could you sort of draw a line between the common purpose and that culture in the late 2000s to COVID now? I mean,
well, I'm going to say, for me, this is a very easy thing to do. Let's deal with what we're up against at the moment. Of course, a lot of people are focused on we'll call it the hard facts of vaccines. Whatever you think about COVID, let's assume that there is some form of flu-y type virus around, and it's severe enough that if you're vulnerable and elderly, you can die. And the response of the government is to say that we're all going to be injected with a pharmaceutical product. That's hard reality. But there's something else that's going on, and we can call it propaganda, because there is a massive, massive propaganda exercise, control of the media going on in order to facilitate everything around COVID-19 and lockdown and vaccinations. But alongside the propaganda that we can see as the adverts in the paper, or for example, that absolutely disgraceful broadcast that Boris Johnson gave last to the nation last night, pitiful broadcast. Alongside that type of propaganda, we've got something much deeper, and that is the use of applied behavioural psychology to change the way people think and behave. And the track for that psychology, if viewers, listeners want somewhere easy to start, they should simply search online for a document called Mindspace, that's MIND. SPACE, all one word, mindspace.pdf. And if you search for that, you'll find the British Cabinet Office document dated 2010. And if you go, I suggest you read it all, you should, because it's important. But if you go to the bottom of page 66, there is a paragraph which says that we, the British government, can change the way people think and behave, and they will not even know this has happened. Or if they realise their behaviour has changed, they will not know how it was done. Now, this is very dangerous applied psychology, which is now fully in the hands of the British government via essentially the Behavioural Insights Team, which was an integral part of the Cabinet Office. But this was the type of applied behavioural psychology which Common Purpose was using in order to reframe its so-called future leaders. So when I look back to the work that I did in the very, very early 2000s, and a little bit before, when I was aware of Common Purpose and I was tracking what was happening with them, they were choosing people in all sectors of society, could be public sector, schools, businesses, police, military, NHS, even within Parliament, and those people were being gently reframed to hold new values. So Common Purpose was effectively the Trojan horse that was putting its people in positions of power and influence across the whole fabric of government and our society. And so when we march through the 2000s, let's take ourselves into somewhere like 2010, 2012, what you can see is these chosen leaders are the people who are the ones helping to facilitate all of the policy that we can now see is being used to enact everything to do with COVID and the vaccines. So
could I just interrupt? I should have explained for the audience that Common Purpose was ostensibly a management training organization. When was it founded? I think it was
1985,
right,
is when Julia Middleton, the then chief executive, said that it was formed. And her story is that she'd been over in America, and previously she'd worked for the Industrial Society, which is a so-called think tank. But she'd then been in America, I believe she was in Chicago, and working with the Chicago Set, i.e. Barack Obama's roots. And she discovered this wonderful system, and then she came back to UK, and she said she was able to raise a large sum of money through a number of banks. She would never disclose which banks, but we know Deutsche Bank was one of them. And then all of a sudden, Common Purpose popped up everywhere in the country to train thousands and thousands of these future leaders. So it called itself a charity, but its whole basis was political. And indeed, at one stage, they were actually operating out of the office of the Deputy Prime Minister when John Prescott was having his dalliances in Westminster.
You see, this is I muted you, Alex, just because there was background noise, but you can unmute yourself with the... But let me just...
Yes, thanks for that. But just at this point in the narrative, she came back in 85, but I have her pamphlet from 1981 published in Britain, entitled Quality Circles, and published under her maiden name. And the point of that was, she doesn't give details on which American industrialists and Chicago Satanists gave her orders, but it basically says the plebs produce poor work in Britain, and in order to get them to do as they're told, they're going to have to engage in struggle sessions, sit in circles and tell each other what they did wrong this week. That was the founding idea.
Right. And that's reframing. Doing that is starting to get people to talk in that way in front of other people is reframing.
Yeah. So I think one of the reasons this is significant is there's one theory of what's going on now is that it's a decentralized, just sort of amorphous social force, social consensus that has a thousand ways of reinforcing itself. But I think Common Purpose indicates that actually this is quite top down. It's quite coordinated. It results in a social consensus and a managerial consensus. But it's created in the first place, generated by in a very deliberated way, a very conscious way. And of course, there's a lot of effort and a huge amount of funding that goes into making that happen. And in the case of Common Purpose, you've got an organization that, in the 2000s, it became apparent, and I think this was because of New Labour largely, but maybe it pre-existed that, there was a lot of movement between large corporations, government, charities, NGOs, people would show up. I mean, a good example since then would be Nick Clegg, who was first in the EU, then he was a British national politician, and now he's working at Facebook. He's very high up at Facebook. I mean, that's a perfect career.
Actually, Colin, what happened in Scotland in the same time frame was a bit the other way around, but with the same results in the end. Because people came in from US-based globalist think tanks, and a few, I think, from big tech. David might know more than I do. But then with the sudden and unexpected collapse of the Labour vote in Scotland and the SNP forming a government in 2007 with an ideological vacuum, other than blaming the English, this created the perfect opportunity for people to be brought in, many of them actually from Mandarin lives south of the border. Sir David Elvidge, who became the top civil servant in ScotGov, the Scottish government, in the early SNP period. Bill Alexander, the Englishman who ended up running the child department at Highland Council, pioneering the named person scheme. And some of these people, if I'm not mistaken, David, have gone into financial situations after their time in government, thus being exactly the opposite of what was happening in England at the time.
So, I mean, and Sir John Elvidge was, of course, common purpose to the core. He was a common purpose supremo. He was taken by common purpose to take the message of the charity to Hong Kong once he was finished running Scotland. And his big innovation was the Scottish model of government, which had been running for about 7 years by the time I found out it existed. And that was no departmental boundaries. It's one organisation. And when you factor in the common purpose approach, which is networks of informal influence and people operating beyond their authority, you end up with a very dangerous situation where you can see what's being done, but there's no clarity as to who is actually responsible for anything, and there's no clarity as to who makes the decisions and who sets the policy. It becomes this iceberg-like mass moving slowly across society and taking all before it. Or, you know, that's what they're trying to achieve.
That's an excellent point. Thank you for it, because that's a very good summary of what this actually does. And I think the phrase "leading beyond authority," was that not the title of her book, Julia Middleton's book?
Right? Yes.
What could either any of you give a summary of what that actually implies? What leading beyond authority? Because obviously it's going to cause a lot of fuzziness about, as you just said, David, about who did what, who's responsible for this, who should be appealed to, who should be persuaded, talked down. Leading beyond it. So
it's probably one for Brian, yeah. But Brian, in your answer, don't forget to mention the unification of Cornwall Council, because that's a good nutshell example of how even elected councillors are told we have cabinet responsibility, which has the same effect. Nobody's responsible for anything, just as in the Scottish model of government. All the ministers act as one.
Well, yeah, that's certainly part of it. I think I might just come in a little bit below that, if you like, and say that what Common Purpose did is that once it got itself established in a city, it would seek out people of influence, people that it thought were worthy of coming into its courses, and then it would mix groups of people. So in a Common Purpose course, you might have somebody from the local police, somebody from a couple of schools, somebody from the local council, and they would all be invited to talk on various subjects about their own job in the first instance. And the other members, of course, would find this interesting and they would learn from that. But what they were doing with the people is saying, well, here you are as a group of people. You've come together. You're not in your normal professional role. And we can now throw problems at you and ask you how you would solve them. So what is happening very subtly is that you're taking people outside the boundaries of their own expertise and their own professional limitations. If we focused on a police officer, that would make life quite simple for us. But now in this new group of people, they start to have a look at how they would solve problems of crime in the city, or how they would deal with problems of health within the city. And with the addition of some nice evenings out and people being able to sit down, eat together and have a drink together, teamwork forms amongst this group of people, and they form the view that they now have the ability to work I'm deliberately going to use this phrase, outside their existing professional silos. This is an expression by Julia Middleton. They're going to come outside their silos and work with other people they don't usually work with in order to solve problems. And then Common Purpose stirs the pot and helps this process by linking together people that have been trained with Common Purpose courses so that they continue to work unseen across the city. And the best example I can give of this was that in Plymouth, at one stage, I'd never heard of Common Purpose. Then I discover it. Then I discover it's prevalent in a lot of organisations and professions in Plymouth. But I then discover that people who were sat alongside me in the Chamber of Commerce were Common Purpose trained, but they never mentioned it. But what they were doing unseen, and the Daily Mail, when it printed its 11 pages on Common Purpose, described it as a quasi-Masonic organisation. And what they were getting at was that Common Purpose people liaised with each other unseen. So you've created a group of people who believe they've been selected as future leaders and that they are now going to be working to solve problems outside of the limitations of their normal professional job. It's a very clever, very devious system.
But hold on a second, right, David. I just want to get this clarified, because some people would say that actually sounds like a good idea to blend different people's expertise, their experience, the attitude that each one has adopted in his profession. He can give fresh insights to someone else in some other profession. So it's new ways of thinking about problems. Some people would say that sounds good.
Well, they could say that. And I could go so far as to say, yep, there are some positive elements in doing that. However, when you start to see the Common Purpose documents showing, for example, that where they set up advisory boards and in a city when they'd got people that they knew they'd got them as Common Purpose graduates, as for future leaders, and these people had some gravitas in their position. Maybe they were the chief executive of the local council. Maybe they were quite a senior policeman in the local police force. They put these people on what they called Common Purpose advisory boards. And those advisory boards would then seek out the next people to be trained. But the point I really want to make is that we were able to show documentation where Common Purpose was telling the local police Common Purpose advisory board member what they were to do. And they were also, particularly in local authorities, telling the Common Purpose graduate that they'd obtained to help them seek funding from the council in order to train more people. Why can I be very confident about this? Because I have a very old website, but the data is still absolutely correct. The website is called cpexposed.com. And if you go onto that website, there's a database system where you can search for documents and you can read the actual documents that we were able to obtain now many years ago, but they still show the evidence where Common Purpose was absolutely using people in very important positions, chief executives in local authorities, in the NHS, police. They were even getting into military camps to do training, which I found astonishing. And Common Purpose was instructing their graduate within the police or the NHS or the local authority to do their bidding.
So in other words, these graduates, these members of a Common Purpose are, regardless of their profession, in some sense, they are working for Common Purpose, even in their day-to-day lives.
Yes.
Yes, yes, absolutely. I looked up the string GCHQ, my former employer, Britain's Signals Intelligence Agency, on Brian's website, cpexposed.com, and I found three names. To my astonishment, two were people that I knew well, one personally and one by repute on the staff newsgroups. And both of these two had been initially on message with the thinking of most of the staff. And sometime in the mid-2000s, which I think correlated with when Brian had records of them being trained and becoming a graduate of Common Purpose, they became unrelentingly hostile to the old ethos of GCHQ.
That's incredible. So did you actually witness that?
Yes, and it wasn't just my personal impression. In one of the cases, the person who had taken this course at GCHQ and become a Common Purpose graduate was described by at least two of my other very solid older colleagues as a changed person, as not the person they were before, a new set of values, attacking their old person, their old self.
That's so sinister. David, can I bring you back in to ask to answer the question of what is meant by leading beyond authority? And you can talk about Scotland then.
Yes, this is, sorry for butting in there a moment ago. This is what I was going to say is you raised the issue about the link between Common Purpose and the COVID policy.
Yes.
And this is the link in my view is the whole concept of leading beyond authority. Because we have, well, in Scotland, we've got Devi Sridhar. And I understand that Nicola Sturgeon doesn't, or at least wouldn't, do a thing on COVID policy without Devi's say-so. Devi Sridhar is 37 years old. She's an Indian-American. She's a Rhodes Scholar. And she's written a book called Governing Global Health with Chelsea Clinton. But she's making decisions that alter society. She's deciding when the economy closes down. She's deciding when children can see faces of adults. She's deciding when people can go to school, children could go to school. She's deciding when you can go to a hospital to see your elderly relative. She's deciding everything about how we operate. Based on what? Where's the authority? It's so far beyond the authority, you can't see it. And there is a requirement for an almost unbelievable amount of arrogance to think that you can organize society based on either a niche bit of information, because you've done some work in epidemiology, or you've done perhaps some rather badly executed computer programming, and you have a model that's predicting the future course of pandemics. And that makes you somehow qualified to instruct the world or the nation on everything.
And I have a nice update on this. I have a nice update on this, David, because when you were on UK Column News today, as you always are on Mondays, one of the segments was about Boris Johnson getting at number 10 Downing Street an equivalent of Devi Sridhar, someone to tell him what to do. And it's a chap called Dan Rosenfield, who had an incredible and improbable rise from being a German graduate or a graduate in the German language to being a Treasury bod. And here's the link. The New Statesman, as we quoted today, is tapping up former colleagues for what this Dan Rosenfield is going to do to be the enforcer, as he's called, at Downing Street, the man without whom Boris Johnson will not sleep, yea, will not wake. And this is it. The former Treasury colleague says, the truth is that number 10 has not yet recovered from the tragic early death of Sir Jeremy Hayward, the last enforcer. Dan Rosenfield is potentially a worthy successor to Jeremy. He is somebody who understands morale, maths, markets, MI6 and MI5. If you're looking for somebody who can operate well in the deep centre, Dan Rosenfield has got the full package, end of quote. I've never heard of the deep centre before. I thought we were supposed to be on top of these things, but that shows you something. And then in the next paragraph in their own rubric, the New Statesman add that what the deep centre means is the most important decision making across the institutions of government. And the New Statesman says that Rosenfield's knowledge of this deep centre is considered his greatest asset.
would one way to characterize this be that it's the sort of clandestine implementation of a technocracy?
Yes.
All right, okay.
A managerial state. The idea that democracy, for all of its flaws, means you have some control, has been, well, that's gone, but it's been removed very subtly. So,
yeah, you've done a lot of reading, David, of the golden, well, not anti-golden period around 1948. One of the many books that came out this year, and it's been touted in the Dutch Parliament. I live in the Netherlands here now, so I know this, is a book by James Burnham in the US called The Managerial State, just about this. And the subtitle, when it was first published, is What is Happening in the World Today? So Burnham, who was no sloucher, thought this was a key thing about the post-war world, and the institutions were many of them, especially in Britain, forged in that year, 1948. It was the go-ahead for technocracy.
And so it's almost embarrassing that we're only catching up with it and defining it.
We were the first 2 or 3 years ago to discover a memorandum from, I think, the 3rd or 4th of January, 1948. If I got the date right, so just after the New Year break or during it, Prime Minister Clement Attlee dictated a memo saying Britain is going to invent something called European Military Union. Nobody reported on that for decades until we did in 2018, 2019, I think, gentlemen.
Yeah.
European Military Union, would that be the start of the EU?
Well, yes, that's the whole point. It was, these guys need military union, therefore we're going to have to invent a political pretext for it. So we're going to, in the first instance, tell Benelux to start existing, because the Belgians and Dutch had been often former foes. But the Belgians, Dutch and Luxembourgers were told, once their government in exile returned at the end of the war, if you want any Marshall Plan money, you're going to have to become a quasi-unified state with no customs borders between you. And then that was then spun out to the whole EU.
Right. So it's the sort of artificial merging of states, so that they're more managerially convenient.
That's exactly it. Yeah, sorry about the clock chiming in the background. I've just muted most of that, but that's exactly what it is. The long history of technocracy preferring to work at a European level, but the key thing is it came out of Manhattan and the City of London. There's no aspect of European unification after the war. And I've been burying my nose in continental documents as long as I've been over here. Like, I've never found anything in French, German, Italian, or Dutch which suggests that the original six members of the EEC, well, let's remove Germany and Italy because they were the foes, right? But let's say the continental allies, right? So France and Benelux, there's no evidence that they innately and genuinely wished for any kind of union on any level. You know, that Jean Monnet was, as reported widely in books such as The Great Deception by Booker and North, was widely, and including by de Gaulle, correctly understood to be an Anglo-American stooge with bad debts to, shall we say, deep state companies. In his case, the Hudson's Bay Company, but it's just one of the many tentacles of the old money in the city.
Gosh, there's so much to know, isn't there? There's so much to find out. I mean, I can just imagine a dense fabric of deals and organizations and bribery, blackmail.
Yeah, I mean, the Italians were co-opted pretty soon. There wasn't much bribery needed there. They just took old unreformed commies like Alberto Spinelli, who has, you know, rooms in his honour at the European Parliament these days, and Antonio Gramsci. He hadn't got any suite of rooms named after him in Brussels, but he was of the same era. And down at the Italian end, they were just openly writing, we need to do this to overturn the patriarchy. Yeah, but in France and Benelux, it was a bit more dressed up as, we won't be able to suck the teat of Anglo-American investment if we don't do this.
Right. So what, and this is a very sort of open question, what is the top level of this web, as it were?
I mean, Brian, you know, and I have answered this enough times in our own words in previous interviews. I've never heard David go for that one, so I'm very intrigued what he might say.
Because obviously, just to introduce this, you can talk about the manager of a leisure centre in Nottingham, that would be the bottom level. But then you go up through the echelons, and do we end at the EU? Do we end at the British national level? Do we end at the UN? How high does it go?
We can't end at the UN. I'll say this before I hand over to David. We can't end at the UN because we know who created the UN. It was created on privately owned land in San Francisco in an irregularly and not according to international law of an irregularly called meeting. And it was not really the diplomatic envoys that got it going. It was a wartime slogan that the Allies had become the United Nations as of 1943, which Roosevelt was already talking about. So, over to David. He's looked into this more deeply.
Oh, I don't know about that. I find this one of the hardest questions. I think the column finds this one of the hardest questions. Right? Where do the instructions actually come from? Because it's manifestly not the people you're seeing. At a low level, I had the pleasure of going along to an SNP Yes Movement meeting in Perth at the Salutation Hotel some years ago. And I went there just to ask some questions and see what would happen. And it was remarkable because it was all tactics. They were getting people G'd up for the next independence referendum. This would be about 2017, I think. All right, so they thought we're going to go again. And clearly there was a tactic. The tactic was we're going to do just what we did the last time, but the Labour Party's collapsing, so we'll win this time. That was it. It didn't go any further than that. And it was all the discussion was mobilising the troops. Who would go where? How we'd get people out in the street, how we'd get little shops set up and street stalls and badges and things. But there was no ideas. And I found this very funny. So I asked them, you know, what's the policy relating to Scottish independence? And where does the policy come from? And there was a kind of embarrassed silence in the top table. And they could, well, you might try Commonweal. Really? So they actually had no idea where the policies were coming from. And that problem is visible at national cabinet level as well. So it doesn't reside there. So when you go to the World Bank, the World Economic Forum, the World Health Organization, some of the UN bodies, getting closer to it, but it's not quite there either.
When you get to the Bank for International Settlements, you're getting perhaps a wee bit closer. A
wee bit closer.
But then above them, because they own the central banks that own the banks and et cetera, et cetera. And of course, the level above that is what's interesting. Hedge funds and private investors, the same people who set up the world's first central banks, the Bank of Sweden, the Bank of England, the Bank of Scotland, the Bank of France, the same clubs. Around 1700, these people turn out to be closely guarded lists of shareholders. Right? So they are both acting above and below the level of the banks. And they are signaling often in their dummy run exercises and their think pieces and their think tanks what is going to be the policy at the level David just mentioned, like the World Health Organization. Yeah, but there's clearly capture of many of these organizations. Anything like that calls itself the World Health Organization or the American Medical Association sounds like it is, a conclave of the best minds in that case, the discipline of medicine. But they are bought and paid for. You know, we know the date and format, for example, in which David Rockefeller bought up, or the Rockefeller clan of his age of that time bought up the AMA. In fact, called it into existence. And likewise, Gates has played that role with regard to the WHO and got it diplomatic status in Switzerland. So you're looking to a small number of old money families.
When you say Gates and you say Rockefeller, you're immediately talking about the tax-exempt foundations, right? And the Dodds report that gives you information about that. So that level of control of big money, where the people who actually made the money are long gone, but there are people who control it and who have agendas, and the agendas are very difficult to get at. And then you've got the question, what makes the agenda? And then you're getting into criminality, sometimes Satanism, sometimes various forms of belief. You're getting into the spiritual war. And ultimately, my view is that that's ultimately the battle you're fighting. It's principalities and powers. It's not any easily identified human organization.
Thank you. That's a very interesting answer. Brian, would you like to have a go at this question?
Well, I'm going to say I fully support where we've just got to, but I'd just like to put in an intermediate step, and that is that if we're happy with the concept, the common purpose established itself in order to choose future leaders, which it recruited, it trained, it then let loose in order to seed and propagate its own agenda, we can move up the ladder to somewhere like the World Economic Forum, where we've got Klaus Schwab running an organization that is selecting global leaders. And today on the UK Column News, we mentioned a website which has got a very good list of names, which I took the trouble just to call up. The website is called Tara Blue, which is TaraBlue, Tara Blue or Blue.com. And you will find on that website a very nice list of all the world leaders who have actually been recruited and trained through Klaus Schwab's World Economic Forum system. So we can now show that across the world, in all sorts of different countries, we've got leaders, political leaders or leaders within corporations or foundations, who have been trained through the World Economic Forum system. So we can see Klaus Schwab, we can understand a bit about him because we can read what he's happy to declare about himself. But really, we have to ask a question: who put Klaus Schwab in the position he's in? Who provides him with the money to enable him to do what he's doing? And very quickly, we've moved from the World Economic Forum global leaders through to the fact that the people who control that must be people who also control money. And it's the same with Bill Gates. You can look at Bill Gates and say, well, Bill Gates is a very powerful man. Well, he is by what he does on the ground. But actually, if he's got billions squirreled away in bank accounts, the people who own Bill Gates are the people who control his bank accounts. So it's very easy to climb up the pyramid, and it has to be the people that control the money who are at the top. But I think the weakness that I'll say many of us, because I used to fall into the same trap. What happens with people is they then just focus on the money people that we know. So they will talk about Rothschilds or the Rockefellers. But I'm going to say that the trouble with that is that they are people we see. I think the people really inventing the policy and driving it through are people who have immense financial control within these private banking systems. But we don't even know who their names are.
I'll give a stab. I'll tell you in general terms, and I said this in one of my most popular talks at Alternative View, when I talked about the bloodlines and the history of the world. There's said to be 13 families, often called satanic bloodlines, and Rothschild and Rockefeller are often called number one and number two on that list. But every time I've mentioned that, and I think the authors of the concept as well, Robin de Ruyter and Fritz Springmeier would be quick to add this, I always add these are the visible guys, as Brian was just saying. Above and beyond them, you have got basically in the part of the world I'm in now, from about the North Sea down to northern Italy, which has always been the linchpin of European and world economic progress and where the monopolies and the cabals hang out. That's where you've got the really old families that shun publicity. They tend to have French or Italian names, although some of them migrated to what's now Germany during the Middle Ages. And some of the names that keep popping up there are Orsini, Pallavicini, Heiser, Breakspear, an English name, as a family that supplied England's one and only Pope in history, and also some of the minor, now minor seeming, Bavarian princely dynasties. That area of the world, Switzerland and Austria is right in the middle of it too, but Belgium and southern Netherlands as well, those families are to this day where you find the de facto monopoly. For example, there's a big five set of companies that control most of the primary food supply in the world, certainly grain. And to this day, even though the US and Canada and Russia supply far, far more grain than other parts of the world, obviously, look at the map, the companies that make sure that food gets sold, ultimate ownership of those companies is still in the continent of Europe, not even the city of London. So we're looking a bit more closely there. And in with regard to that, I don't want to get into the debate about the Jesuits, but it's interesting that some of the people who were at the very top of Britain's let's have war with Russia agenda a couple of years ago, people who were, as I found out, pulling the strings of the top Foreign Office experts on Russia and neighbouring countries at the time I was in service. David did some personal digging because some of them turned out to be registered to a disused mill just down the road from him. And we found an undue prevalence, didn't we, David, of Irish Catholic priests and strange things going on in the leadership of the thought of what of these groups like the Integrity Initiative. And again, I'm quick to add, I'm not saying the Roman Catholic Church is the top layer, but you know, this is again old money Vatican area, Central or Western Europe. That seems to be where all the nodes come together before we lose track of them.
Well, the Integrity Initiative was an interesting sort of diversion over the last 2019, 2020 sort of area, just before COVID. And it was an organisation with very little substance and a great deal of influence. And it was made up of a former NATO official, a businessman with a very interesting past and the ability to get spirited out of places like Beirut quite quickly, who was probably some sort of spook, secret service, and a former Roman Catholic priest who was then running a charity to bring peace, love and harmony to the Middle East. And they decided that what they were going to do was sort out the narrative with respect to Russia, and get involved in all forms of communication and shaping the narrative. And they were, whether they originated or whether they were repeating, they were going over ideas which we were finding were being parroted in the top of the British Army, the top of the United States Air Force and Navy, all of these, you know,
they got in one day, they got Major Pedro Baños, a very fine Spanish officer, sacked just at the time his candidature was announced or his selection was announced to be Spain's new national security advisor, simply through pulling strings with their own people and the press. But go on, David.
And what they were saying was concepts like the peace and war is not a binary. You can never know whether you can never be entirely at peace or entirely at war. That's old-fashioned thinking, like men, women, I suppose. But that's old-fashioned thinking. Everything, you're always at war in a funny kind of way. And everything that your country does and is part of that war. So your industry, okay. Your culture, your churches, your belief system, your education system, your everything, the degree to which your population will be obedient to the state, that's a weapon of war. Everything is a weapon of war. And it's live and it's active and we have to be aggressive and we have to be going out and we have to be defeating these pesky Russians in this battle of ideas. And it looks like the sort of tactics that the Soviet Union were running to destabilize the West, we were running to destabilize Russia. And
And there's a closer link than that, actually, because the very successful and little talked about German equivalent of GCHQ in the Third Reich was the Forschungsamt, literally the research bureau, and all its best tricks, such as plotting what the population was thinking and shifting the Overton window, went hook, line and sinker over to a private corporation, the MITRE Corporation on the west coast of the US, which is a big NSA data holder and contractor. And one of the GCHQ heroes of the war, Gordon Welchman, and we know this is genuine because he unexpectedly got prosecuted by the FBI in the States, with the Brits leaning on him. So genuine disclosure. He, in all innocence, at the end of his career in the late 70s, wrote the Hut 6 story, is the name of his book on my part in deciphering Nazi codes. And the last chapter, which is probably what he really got persecuted for, because when the book was reissued, it was taken out, is one in which he gaily says, yes, well, from now on, the enemy is the domestic population. There's going to be this thing called domestic extremists, and that's where the enemy is going to pop up. So we have to be ever vigilant and monitor the totality of telecoms. So that thinking comes right from both totalitarian models of the early 20th century, which is yet one more indication that the thinking behind those models, I think, was neither German nor Russian, but more at home in the City of London than in Wall Street.
And when you go round to, what I said earlier on, that ultimately it's a spiritual battle. If you view life as an extension of warfare, there's no possibility of peace with your fellow man, it's just a different way of dominating him. If your view is that it's ultimately a great big survival of the fittest Darwinist world, then that generates a certain society. That generates a certain way of treating your fellow man. And that generates a lot of the... It generates an atmosphere and a background where organisations like Common Purpose can thrive, because there is no alternative spiritual viewpoint to push back against them, because it's all just about, you know, survival and competition and some sort of social Darwinist process. So where's my advantage this week? There's yeah. Nothing. The finer points of life, the nobler ideals, these are viewed as irrelevant or old fashioned or out of date or
weak. They're viewed as weak. Yeah.
Weak. Yeah.
But a lot of them are British thinkers, you know, because it's Malthusianism. A lot of the best dissidents these days, from clergymen through to former bankers, are saying we're up against Malthusianism, right? But Thomas Malthus has a direct line through to Francis Galton, the cousin who basically ghost wrote or whispered ideas to Darwin, particularly on his less scientifically based social Darwinism side. Galton lived rather longer than Darwin, right until the eve of the First World War, and was a mate of the Huxley brothers, whose father was quite a dodgy character in himself. But Julian, who wrote the Charter for the World Health Organization, the only so-called UN body which has a constitution, by the way, another example of how private money put things into operation and gave them the mandates. And of course, Aldous, who did it more in fiction through Brave New World, they're both saying this is going to be the way of the world from now on. You know, so again, we're back with a few rather disproportionately British as well, old money families. Saying that this, you know, that nature will be red in tooth and claw, basically.
Well, I suppose that brings us to COVID and the present era. I don't even know how to approach this, because there are so many things that have been said that could link to it. But let's say that there is a program of subdue the general public. And you know, condition them for a certain future in which they will be much less numerous. Would that be accurate?
For me, it would be. There's a cull. There's no question of the fact that very large numbers of people, certainly in UK, but in other countries, but we can talk with confidence in UK, large numbers of particularly elderly, vulnerable people have already been killed off.
And that's even before we get to the vaccine. The vaccine seems, because a lot of elderly people were killed off. Well, let's say that they died in 2020 through being stuffed into care homes and so on.
Well, but,
Go on.
Can I just interject there? Sorry to do that, but I'm going to say no, actually, well before that, because one of the key clues we got to what the real agenda was is if we go to Staffs Hospital in UK, where it emerged that supposedly thousands of elderly people had died unnecessarily as a result of hospital procedures. But some time ago, I was able to speak to a key individual who'd been part of the government's initial investigation team into the mid-staff hospital crisis. And they said to me, I was sat in their own home, they said to me that actually the investigation revealed that the numbers were not 1,500, 2,500 people who died in mid-staff. So they were up in the 10, 11, 12, 13, 14,000 people, and similar levels of death were actually occurring in at least, quote, 10 or 11 hospitals.
And this was a good 5 or 6 years before COVID.
Yeah. So this individual was talking up towards 100,000 of elderly people who were dispatched.
And we were getting undertakers from various parts of Britain as well. Yeah, I don't want to steal your thunder, but this was also at the same time frame. But go on.
Just before you go in that direction, Alex, so this was happening in Mid-Staffs Hospital. There was an inquiry team put together, and they submitted a report exposing that this was the level of deaths, which was much, much higher than the level being reported publicly. What then happened was a new team was brought in, which subsequently whitewashed the original report. And the reason that the particular individual got in contact with me was because the name of the new team that the government brought in to do that whitewash was called the Common Purpose Team. And
that's rather telling.
That was one incident, but also, of course, we had the Liverpool Care Pathway running, which was sold as being a way of giving people the so-called good death. But then it emerged that, of course, people were being killed via that system. And the reality that we see as a result of our own research and many good and detailed reports from people in the NHS is that the Liverpool Care Pathway never stopped. It continued, although it was continuing undeclared as to what it was by name. So they didn't use Liverpool Care Pathway, but they were definitely killing people. And then we arrive at the situation where we had the start of the COVID crisis, where they knowingly discharged elderly people who had COVID, who were in hospital beds. They discharged them into care homes, residential homes, and locked them down with the other vulnerable elderly people. And of course, the deaths, tens of thousands reported in the paper, but the reality is hundreds of thousands. Those deaths have been noted and recorded. The Independent, The Express, The Mirror, even the Daily Mail has talked about this, but nobody's followed it through.
It's so evident that Scotland's corrupt Crown Office, the monopoly prosecutor, had to open a case against a care home on the Isle of Skye in Portree for that very culpability. You know, and in most cases, the Crown Office and similar continental monopoly state prosecutors will simply ditch the nearly half of their caseload that they don't think is going to be easy to prove or not politically opportune. But it was so glaringly obvious that they've run with it for quite a while at the Crown Office. Other things that happened well before COVID, mid-2010s, besides the things Brian mentioned, were a string of undertakers from various parts of Britain. talking to us about distressingly large numbers of elderly and children deceased coming to them in an emaciated state. And we and a number of other free media outlets were broadcasting with face and voice unaltered at that time as well, people who had left care homes talking about the deliberate dehydration, whether it was called care pathway or not, or just a bunch of thuggish carers within a local care home. There was a deliberate withholding of water from people in care homes. And then by horrible things like giving the elderly foul water to drink and then saying, you see, she doesn't want to drink. And we then went a step further and spoke to a gentleman in Chester, Dr. Mark Jones, very well qualified, and he's never given up on his mother's case, who is speaking in quite lurid terms, but with the evidence, about a bunch of bent lawyers in towns like Chester, no doubt up and down the country, but there's a particular concentration there, who managed to be in league with certain staff in their care homes to such an extent that the smothering by a pillow or the dehydration magically happens just in the same time window of certain weeks when the legacy runs out. You know, when there's no more money to be milked from the system. So this was all in place well before COVID. And very similar things, I can tell you, have been going on for 20 years here in the Netherlands, which is famous for being pioneers of things like euthanasia and the doctor killing you. It's just that there's less speaking out over here. And I have to say, even more fear of the doctor among the elderly over here, because they don't make any bones about it over there. It's just, okay, time for your death jab now.
David, you've done some interviews with nurses who've been aware of these sorts of things happening.
Well, yes. The nurses are, they're astonished with what actually went down. Some aspects of it, you have one very bizarre thing, and I was speaking to a senior consultant in a Scottish hospital on this subject, just to check that I had interpreted this correctly. He confirmed it, that what happened when COVID came in, you had maybe 150 years worth of medical practice, building experience on experience, refining safety protocols and developing the most effective way so that you could cut someone open, take a bit out, stitch them back together, and they live without infection and without, you know, any more distress than is necessary. And all of these processes had been improved since, you know, the days where it was a literally a theatrical performance where speed was everything because there was no anesthesia and there was no antiseptic. And after all of this improvement, they had all of these procedures to how you treat people who are ill, whether it's operations or whether it's ill with other things. And COVID came along and there was panic and all of the processes got binned and they started changing the most fundamental parts of how people were handled, where they're prepared for surgery, where they come round after surgery, how they're monitored. All the fundamentals got changed in what looked like a moment of blind panic because they were so convinced that COVID was this unbelievable killer. This is so deadly. This is the end of the world type scenario.
Well, there was the footage coming out of China of people just sort of slouching around zombie like and dropping dead in the street,
and statistics coming out of Italy, which later proved to be not true. But the initial message was this is terrifying, and the medical profession dropped all of its protective procedures and tried to rewrite them all on the hoof. And that really happened. So that caused a lot of problems. You had lots of just bad practice was introduced. And this is what the nurses were speaking out. You can't do that. That's not safe. And you're not allowed to speak out in, you know, the society in which we currently live. If you work, particularly if you work for an arm of the state, your comments and criticisms are not required. If we want you to have an opinion, we'll give it to you.
So thou shalt not blaspheme the name of the NHS, thy God.
Yeah, they got pressured. And then you had things like the vaccination program was being run out. And we picked this up very quickly and asked questions to the Scottish government. You're running a vaccination program into the care homes because it's the elderly that got it first. And as soon as you run that out, there was a doubling or tripling of the death rate. There was a huge spike in death.
When did that happen? Lasted
for 3 weeks.
When did that happen? Was that at the start of this year?
Yes, from December through to February this year. Yeah. So there's a huge spike in deaths because the mechanism's known because the vaccines, the jabs, cause a collapse or certainly a huge reduction in the natural immune system.
Yeah, if you want to see the pictures, we have a bit of a coup as of last night. Friday night. Anyway, go to ukcolumn.org and look for the recent Doctors for COVID Ethics Symposium. And the first presentation given in that video you'll find there is almost the only pathologist in the world that has bothered to report to the world about cutting open patients who had died after COVID jabs and finding the B lymphocytes. It is lymphocytes and various other types of cells clustered right inside the organs. I've probably got the name of the cells wrong there, Brian. You must correct me.
Well, the main thing they were pointing out was what they were talking about, the spiked proteins, but they were showing...
Well, it's the response to them that it is done by these... I always hate getting medical details wrong, but it's a certain kind of leukocyte. The killer cells cluster inside the organs because they see that every organ is expressing the spike protein that's triggered as a result of getting the genetic jabs.
Yeah. So these were actually shown on screen... are the tissue slides with a qualified professional describing what you can see, slides around the heart or the heart membranes, kidneys, skin. And there was also another professional showing computer images of people's eyes, retinas, and showing the damage that had occurred to those from vaccines. So, as Alex has said, if people go to that symposium, instead of listening to us, they can listen to the qualified medical professionals describing the damage they're seeing inside bodies as people's bodies as a result of vaccination.
And the 3 week spike in death rate that was replicated as the vaccination program ran through the population doing cohort by cohort. So, started off with over the 80s and then went in roughly decade by decade down through the population. The same spike in death rate was visible in each age interval in turn. And it's quite clearly visible in the stats. And there was a professor of... Professor Fenton, a risk analysis expert, was speaking out on this just a few days ago. So this has happened, and that's, if you like, in addition to the blood clots and the other more direct causes of death, because you're talking there about a reduction in the immune system, and therefore anything that happens to be floating around might kill you. It's of particular concern when you see what's happened over the last 48 hours, where we've been told that essentially the whole of the adult population of the British Isles is going to be vaccinated with a third booster jab inside of 3 weeks. 18 days, 20 million vaccinations. Nothing like this has ever happened before. And... I'm curious as to what will happen if you reduce simultaneously the immune system of basically your entire population all at the one time.
And in the middle of winter.
In the middle of winter.
Actually, it puts me in mind, when you put it like that, of a line in John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress, when one of the ogres in the book, I think it's Giant Pope or Giant Pagan, well, it's probably Giant Pope, says to our hero, "There will be no mending of you till more of you be burned."
Ominous. So if we speak in very general terms, then what has happened over the last 2 years? What is COVID? What is going on? Alex, you take that first. I'll ask each of you in turn, because I want this, like, just speak in general terms, and I'd like your each a summary of that from each of you.
What is going on right now that we're not noticing so much
with COVID? What is COVID? What is the
COVID is? I've been doing a lot of thinking about this recently from as many strands as I can. COVID is the seizing upon a genuinely novel respiratory illness. I'm not sure to what extent, being a layman in medicine, it's respiratory born, but anyway, an illness that's clearly novel and has respiratory symptoms. The greatly inflating of that genuine novel problem in medicine in order to bring about a plan which, as we've been talking about all evening, well, a plan sounds sinister and gets laughed at as a conspiracy theory, so I'll say a determination, a change to society, a weaponization of society that was clearly so advanced by 10 or 15 years ago in the English-speaking countries that the people were being lined up ready for it. And the manifestations that this change will particularly have, as we now see from the economic side, I think Catherine Austin Fitz is by far the best commentator on this. The economic repercussion of this is that within 2 or 3 years, sooner if they can get their programming sorted out, genuine cryptocurrency will have been replaced by something that looks the same, masquerades as the same, but isn't, which is a controlled currency. The link, of course, being digital identity within people's bodies, the tracking of people through not just facial recognition, but their digital, their biometric fingerprint, wherever they go and whatever they do. This is, again, if you listen to Bill Porlek from an interview talking about what's going on in the 70s, this was something that was waiting for the technology to catch up with a plan that the families we've been talking about had back then to track their cattle. So that's the big thing. And then the other big manifestation that's going to be obvious, and I don't mean in the New Age sense manifestation, just the popping up of it, is that there's going to be, I fear, war. And in very general terms, our deep state wants the war to begin this side of 2025, because we might just about still outgun Russia and China and Iran. And their deep state would rather hang back until the latter half of the decade, because then they think they will comprehensively outclass in every domain, including cyber and space. But as with the previous world wars, standing above and behind both sides are the gentlemen who, and a lot of ladies these days, who profit from the arms sales, and particularly from the chance to remake the world and its institutions the day the ceasefire is signed. That is the big plan. And if you want a really zinging sort of one-liner from me at the end, which I don't tend to do, but you ask for it, is I'm fairly confident now that the cabal will pull out as rabbit-like from its hat at some point what you can call alien 9/11, a mixture of exotic weapons and psychographic and holographic technology to tell us that the world's been invaded by so-called aliens, and therefore we must unite under global government to advance said agenda.
Well, okay. All right, let's go to David. COVID, the last 2 years, the Great Reset, lockdowns, the vaccine, what does it all mean? What does it all represent? What has actually been going on here?
Yeah, COVID is control. It's the actual disease. I don't think it was manufactured. I think it's real. I think that the people who are saying that the germ theory of illness is flawed have a point, but I don't know exactly what the correction to the current theory should be. But I think the illness is real. It's not particularly threatening for anyone who's healthy, but it had a very, very good PR consultant, and it was elevated to be a major threat that it never was. And that's given the government's control, unbelievable control. We've seen it in Australia. We've seen it in New Zealand. The Anglo-Saxon countries, you know, the last bastions of liberty that we are, have been amongst the worst, not quite the worst, but certainly amongst the worst, for closing down their own populations. The populations have mostly accepted it so far. And it's given the state a great deal of control. And they will now do something with that control. I'm not quite sure what. And it's been clear to me that the spiritual aspect of this fight is to get people to realise that their compliance is not virtue, their compliance is cowardice.
Yeah. I'm not going to comment on that, but I would certainly agree with that last part. Brian, would you like to give a summary of COVID in the last 2 years, what it represents, what it signifies?
Okay, well, I also believe that the virus exists. I believe that the actual virus that we encountered had been interfered with by the human hand. So I don't regard it as being totally natural. I know there's a lot of discussion about this. And I'm also going to say there are some people who say, well, because the virus has never been, the correct term? It's never been
isolated.
Isolated.
Yeah. Although the virologists say we can't speak of isolation with viruses, but it's all rough terms.
Well, all I wanted to say is that there are some people who say, well, you can't even call it a virus. I'm just going to say I can see people get ill. And I'm old enough to know that in the past people have got ill in a particular way and they feel really bad and they say they've got flu. And some vulnerable people, elderly people with other underlying conditions, can easily die if they get the thing called flu. So I'm going to say for me, I accept this thing called flu exists. But I would agree with the comments that we've then seen this normal natural winter phenomena has been ramped up to literally frighten the pants off people. And on the back of that fear, where we can show that the British government used a group of individuals trained in psychology, the Spy B team, operating alongside its COVID SAGE team, that Spy B team were producing documents saying that the British government should ramp up fear in order to make people better adhere to the policies that they wanted, the lockdown policies. So that's what I see with the background. But then what's been the result of this? Well, we've seen people killed in very large numbers. There is no doubt about this at all. We have seen, I'm going to say, hundreds of thousands of mainly elderly people, but not exclusively, have died. And we've seen our society completely changed in that we have been locked in our own homes. We've seen families divided against each other. We've seen families denied the opportunity to mix and carry on normal family, loving family interactions. And we've also seen society divided in a particularly callous and vicious way. And that is continuing under this latest scam that we've now got, the moronic, the Omicron virus. We are back on this division of society. So the vaccinated are frightened of the unvaccinated people. And we're being told that if you're not vaccinated, you are a threat to society. So in the matter of a couple of years, we've seen the most draconian lockdown of society in a way that I think back now to 20 years ago, 30 years ago, unbelievable where we've come to. People frightened to go out of the house. You can't go to the pub. You can't go to a gym. You can't go to a club. The government is controlling our lives down to who comes into our house. So this is a huge, huge power grab. But the bit that goes with it is the other policies that we see coming out of these globalistic think tanks, such as the World Economic Forum, because alongside AI, where AI and the AI algorithms, the smart technology, are going to run our lives, they're also talking about the transhumanism agenda, where they are working to change us from being human beings into cyborgs or the equivalent. And there's no question that they're doing it in the labs. This is reality. So we'll call it the hidden hand has now taken away basic freedoms. It's locked us down in a way which has made the majority of the country absolutely powerless through fear. And then we can already see where this goes next. The AI is coming in, where everybody is to be tracked and face scanned and fingerprinted wherever they move. Some people are saying the mark of the beast, and I think they're not far off it. And then we are going to be denied the opportunity to be human beings in its true sense. We've even got an attack on men and women now. It's not right to say that there are men and there are women. So the agenda, as you get into these larger policy areas, I think is clearly demonic, or we could call it satanic. But whatever the mind is that's created this situation in the world, to me, is utter evil. And we need to think about it in these terms, and we need to deal with it in these terms, because it is not just political policy. This is not conservative policy or Labour policy or even global policy. This is so bad, it must come from a mind which is demonic.
Yeah, I would echo that. I think that there is a sense of evil permeating all of this. When you see various manifestations of what's going on, families being split apart, families being artificially separated, children not being allowed to cuddle their grandparents, children being raised to be accustomed to distance between them and other people, being paranoid about other people as a biological threat to you. There are so many manifestations here. I agree, it is evil. You see, the thing is, I'm not against hierarchy, and I'm not even against the concept of authority. But I think that we need, you know, society and human beings deserve and need an elite that is humane and sane and kind-hearted. And I think that what we're seeing here is an elite that is anything but those things. Just to end, I think that people like us tend to be very good at finding problems and analysing problems. But I think it would be good to end on some kind of positive advice. And David said earlier that compliance is not virtue, it is cowardice. David, I'll ask you to expand on that, and then I'll ask Brian and Alex to give their own something of advice for people in the coming years.
I think what this has done is it's made resistance easy, because anything normal is resistance. Anything that is not ruled by fear is resistance. You go and you smile at a neighbour, you're resisting. You ask a question, you're resisting. They don't like questions. They can't answer them. It's very funny how things suddenly get reversed when well-placed questions start getting placed. So much of what they do relies on our consent. You know, the little bit at the end of the UK column, and silence is consent. So speaking out, what we've got to do is got to learn to resist. And this is don't accept lies, don't accept half-truths, question what's been told to you, have the confidence to use your own intelligence to see what appears right, and if it doesn't, keep asking questions. The system doesn't really cope well with that at all. So the ability to resist is much broader than it ever was, because the tyranny is much more obvious than it ever was. We are planning on doing a lot of development in the UK column in the next year. Since the COVID thing started, we've gone from being a little organization run by dedication and not much else, to a organization that's starting to look like it's reasonably well founded and looking to expand and looking to put a lot more content on. So it's enabled us to move forward. Lots of other people who are resisting this tyranny will be finding the same thing. The new voices will be emerging. Support people who you consider are telling the truth. Encourage them, subscribe to them, and remove your support from those who are lying to you. Don't subscribe to the BBC. Don't subscribe to the Guardian. Don't do these things. I keep asking questions. And the fight is out there, and it's not far away. You'll find it quite quickly. And if you can lose the fear and enjoy the process of resisting, the world becomes a lot less frightening for a start, very quickly. And it becomes, I wouldn't quite say fun, but there's certainly an element of comedy in it, for sure. And you also find that you make an awful lot of very good friends. You might lose some friends, but you'll make better ones than the ones you've lost.
Right. Thank you very much. Alex, would you like to give your perspective?
Here's our Russian lesson for the evening. Не верь, не бойся, не проси, which means don't believe, don't fear, and don't request. Right, that is the distilled wisdom of all the Soviet dissidents. And in fact, it was quoted by an old mate of mine, Gevorg Viratz, when he appeared on UK Column from Odessa recently. And David went into detail on the communist injunction in the Bible, fear not. He just did so in that little speech, and he did so equally well in a blog you'll find on ukcolumn.org if you search for it, called Fear Not. Fear is pretty obvious to people of all religious persuasions and none as to why it's a bad thing, because, well, in the Christian understanding, it blocks out all the things that there should be, such as fear of your creator and of those who really have authority over you. But the remedy in the Bible is that perfect love, which means mature love, by the way, rather than naive love, the kind of love that says, I must get jabby jabby to protect Gran, right? That's naive love. Perfect love, adult love, casts out fear or drives out fear. So people are aware of that. It's even in the culture through Frank Herbert's Dune. You know, fear is the mind killer. It switches the mind off. It turns you back to the reptilian brain and all these things. So that's been well covered. The other two, which I'm astonished how regularly feature in all the best philosophical and religious writing from around the world, from antiquity onwards, is the other two, shall we say, sources of problems that you can switch off at this point by constantly working on them, are greed and pride. Pride, of course, is often referred to by the Greek word hubris, Latin superbia, and both of these words express more than English pride does, that the problem is not being, you know, genuinely proud of what you and your people have achieved, but rather the problem is thinking of yourself more highly than you ought. And this sets you up for a fall. Pride goes before a fall. So if there's any unexamined assumptions within yourself that, you know, I will just do fine, or I need to be in the lead in whatever, then let that be knocked out of you. You know, we have a great time in the sort of the fraternal atmosphere of UK Column, because without any kind of confrontation, we manage to smooth each other's rough edges by saying, you don't want to be doing it that way, my good fellow. And that works just fine. So wherever you are, you need to be in a small team of people. And as I was saying to some young Dutch people, I was sitting around a table on Saturday with a dozen Dutch dissidents, schooling them in this. And I said, well, the first thing you do is go out in skirmishes together, as we did when we were a small organization, and enjoy your acquiring your battle scars and your wounds. Limp back home and have a post-match confab with each other and say, well, that was fun, wasn't it, guys? If it isn't fun, then you shouldn't be in dissident work, because the enemy can never enjoy what he does. He doesn't have any fun. So that's you've always got one up on the enemy there. So engage in skirmishes, see what worked well as a team, what didn't, and tighten your game. So that's get rid of pride, just be, you know, humble. And the third one is pretty obvious too, greed. Get rid of it in every sense. You know that, that many traditions say you are a slave as many times as you have passions or greeds or desires. So cut out the obvious ones, the ones that plague modern life, like porn addiction, like addiction to the wrong kinds of food. Examine what it is that makes you weak for these things, the feeling of helplessness and emotional damage that comes before indulging in any habit. Turn that into a moment of meditation instead and say, I can live without that. If you're a Christian, say it with Paul in the words of Colossians 3, for ye are dead and your life is hid with Christ in God. So if you can get that sorted out, then the attitude is, well, they can have whatever I, you know, that they can take off me, because that's not the real me. You know, and if it comes to it, if it really does come to being carried off to camps, God forbid, learn from Solzhenitsyn and many others who lived through totalitarianism that, as he said in one of his purple passages in the Gulag Archipelago, how we burned in the camps that we hadn't kicked and screamed when they came for us, right? I am not advocating violence in any situation short of people coming to cart you away. Obviously not. But think of it this way. Anywhere you take your last stand or live out your last days is going to be less comfortable than doing it on your own doorstep. Yeah. I'll just put it that way, but don't let it come to that. So don't fear, or I'll repeat the Russian phrase, не верь, не бойся, не проси, right? Believe not, fear not, request not.
Okay, thank you. Brian, would you like to give some closing thoughts?
Well, thank you for that. It's fascinating, isn't it, when we get to this point. What's in my mind is that just a little while ago, we were trying to pin down who was causing the trouble. So we went up through the structure to the people we thought could be controlling the policy. And we were looking up certainly at international banker level, but above that. And then we come to a little bit of a smoky area, because we realize that we can't actually see the individuals that are really controlling this global totalitarian policy. We can't see them and we can't name them. And on one hand, this makes the battle difficult, because you can't easily fight an enemy that you can't see or you can't detect. But we get told something else. Why are they hidden? And the answer is very simply that they, albeit that they're extremely powerful, they're actually frightened of us. Because if they weren't frightened of us, why would they need to be hidden? So the enemy we're up against is very powerful, very strong in many ways. But ultimately, we're being told, and we can see very clearly, that this enemy is frightened of ordinary people because it hides its face. And so I think that the way we can fight back is so easy, because what do people like to do? People love to talk. This is why mobile phones are so successful, why social media is so successful. People like to talk. But if we're going to use that system to fight, then we've got to focus in on some simple things. We've got to focus in on truth. We've got to make sure that what we're saying is true, and that helps with personal relationships as it does with putting across perhaps a more political answer. We've got to deal in facts and we've got to deal in evidence. So as long as we're talking and interfacing with our fellow human being, men and women, then we've got to be accurate in what we talk about. But if we want to bring down this very powerful, very evil totalitarian regime, We've got to be warning other people about it, and we've got to be showing them what's happening, and we've got to be supporting and winning people over, helping and comforting them. So that's a communication war. And without mentioning any names, there's a channel which calls itself InfoWars. And whatever you think of the individual running that, I've always thought what a brilliant name it was, because we are in an information war. And we can win that war because we have the millions and billions of people worldwide on our side. And we easily outnumber the bad people that we can't see. So my advice is to talk. But when you talk and exchange ideas with other people, you've got to be truthful. You've got to deal with facts and evidence. And you've got to put across your ideas in a way that's loving. And I'm going to say to the audience, I'm still quite surprised to hear myself say this, because if I'd gone back 20 plus years ago to my military time, I would have imagined then I'd be talking more in terms of how many rounds we had, rather than saying we've actually got to use truth and we've got to love one another. But we're up against utter evil. If you want to fight evil, then you're going to have to turn to scriptures, and you're going to have to deal in truth, and you're going to have to treat your fellow man and fellow woman with due love and respect.
Okay. Thank you very much for that. There was actually a question posted which is related to the military, and I wasn't sure how to fit it in, but you've just mentioned the military, so I'll bring it in here. This is a quick question before we end. Is using the 77th Brigade to propagandize COVID a ripping up of the principle of not turning the army against the British public?
Yes, yes. America has the doctrine codified, posse comitatus, but all common law countries have the same. Actually, you cannot use troops in any common law constitution, any English-speaking country's constitution, and all the countries have them. The government lies when it says they don't. You cannot use the troops against the people. You've already forfeited your right to rule that way.
Well, that's something for us all to bear in mind. Okay. Well, thank you very much. I think this has been a really interesting and useful stream. So thank you very much, UK Column.
Okay, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Thank you very much, Colin. It's been a real pleasure.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much. And I'll be back in about 10 minutes with Survive the Jive. In the meantime, bye-bye for now.
Okay, bye-bye.
Millennial Woes has created many things, and this is your chance to own one of them. A unique piece of work handcrafted by the Vile Vlogger to commemorate Millennial 2021. 100 hours of highly skilled labor went into producing this animated vector graphic, which can be magnified to any size. In the iconic Millennial Woes font, it glistens and responds to your touch. And at the center of it all, a figure representative of 2021, the White Stag, symbolizing endurance, discovery, and rejuvenation. This one-of-a-kind creation is up for sale as an NFT. Follow the link below, and it can be yours forever. This is your only chance.